Construction is finished.
When will that be?
Well, they've been building these towers for 5 years already, and there's probably about 3 more years' work in it, maybe more. No one's really sure what'll happen when the buildings are finished. In theory, at least, the slum will be cleared.
Then all this will be gone?
Carla asked, turning to sweep the Hutmut city with her gaze.
All will be gone, Prabhaka sighed.
But today's a big day. The campaign for the school was a long one, and it got pretty violent sometimes. Now the people have won, and they'll have their school, and so there'll be a big celebration tonight. Meanwhile, one of the men who works here has finally got a son, after having 5 daughters in a row. So he's having a special pre-celebration lunch, and everyone's invited.
The village in the sky,
Prabhaka laughed.
Just where is this place? Where are you taking me?
Right here, I replied, pointing upwards. Right up there. We'd reached the perimeter of the legal slum, and the megalithic immensity of the twin skyscrapers loomed before us. Concreting had been completed to 3/4 of their height, but there were no windows, doors, or fittings on the unfinished buildings. With no flash or reflection or trim to relieve the grey massiveness of the structures, they swallowed light into themselves, extinguished it, and became silos for storing shadows. The hundreds of cave-like holes that would eventually be windows allowed a kind of cross-sectional view into the construction. An ant farm picture of men and women and children on every floor, walking to and fro, upward and down, about their tasks. At ground level, the noise was a percussive and exciting music of towering ambition. The nervous irritation of generators, the merciless metal-to-metal zing of hammers, and the whining insistence of drills and grinders. Snaking lines of sari-clad women carrying dishes of gravel on their heads wove through all the workplaces, from man-made dunes of small stones to the yawning mouths of ceaselessly revolving cement mixing machines. To my Western eyes, those fluid feminine figures in soft red, blue, green, and yellow silk were incongruous in the physical turmoil of the construction site. Yet I knew, from watching them through the months, that they were indispensable to the work. They carried the great bulk of stone and steel and cement on their slender backs, one round dishful at a time. The uppermost floors hadn't been concreted, but the framework of upright, transom, and truss girders was already in place, and even there, 35 stories into the sky, women worked beside the men. They were simple people from simple villages, most of them, but their view of the great city was unparalleled, for they were building the tallest structures in Bombay.
Tallest buildings in all India, Prabhaka
said, with a gesture of expansive proprietal pride. He lived in the illegal slum and had nothing whatsoever to do with the construction, but he boasted about the buildings as if they were his own design. Well, the tallest buildings in Bombay, anyway, I corrected. You'll get a good view from up there. We're having lunch on the 23rd floor.
Up there,
Carla said, through an expression of exquisite dread.
No problem, Miss Carla. We are not walking up at this building. We are travelling first class in that very fine lift.
Prabhaka pointed to the freight elevator, attached to the outside of the building in a yellow steel framework. She watched as the platform jerked and rattled upwards on heavy cables with loads of men and equipment.
Oh, swell, Carla said. Now I feel great about it.
I feel great too, Miss Carla,
Prabhaka agreed, his smile huge as he tugged at her sleeve and pulled her toward the elevator.
Come, we will catch the lifts on the next run. They are beautiful buildings, yes?
I don't know. They look like monuments to something that died,
she muttered to me as we followed him.
Something very unpopular. Like the human spirit, for example.
The workmen who ran the freight elevator shouted safety instructions at us, gruff in their self-importance. We climbed onto the wobbling platform with several other men and women, and a wheelbarrow containing work tools and barrels of rivets. The driver blew two shrill blasts on his metal whistle and threw the lever that activated the powerful generators, controlling our ascent. The motor roared, the platform shuddered, throwing us at the panic handles attached to the uprights, and the elevator groaned slowly upwards. There was no cage surrounding the platform, only a yellow pipe at waist height around the three open sides. In a few seconds, we were 50, 80, 100 metres off the ground.
"How do you like it?"
I shouted.
"I'm scared out of my brain,"
she shouted back, her dark eyes shining.
"It's great."
"Are you afraid of heights?"
"Only when I'm on them. I hope you got a reservation at this goddamn restaurant of yours. What are we doing eating lunch here anyway? Don't you think they should finish the building first?"
"They're working on the top floors now. This elevator is constantly in use. It's not usually available for the workers to use. It's reserved for wheelbarrows and building materials and stuff. It's a long climb, up 30 flights of steps every day, and it gets fairly tricky in places. A lot of the people who work these upper floors stay up here most of the time. They live up here, eat, work and sleep. They've got farm animals and kitchens and everything. Goats for milk and chickens for eggs. Everything they need is sent up to them. Sort of like a base camp that mountaineers use when they climb Everest."
"The village in the sky," she shouted back.
"You got it."
The elevator stopped at the 23rd floor, and we stumbled out onto a concrete surface that sprouted clumps of steel rods and wires like metal weeds. It was a vast, cavernous space, divided by equidistant columns and canopied by a flat concrete ceiling adorned with a creepery of cables. Every flat plane was an unrelieved grey, which gave a startling vividness to the human and animal figures grouped on the far side of the floor. An area around one of the pillars was fenced off with wicker and bamboo for use as an animal pen. Straw and hessian was strewn about to serve as bedding for the goats, chickens, cats and dogs that foraged amid discarded food scraps and rubbish in the pen. Rolled blankets and mattresses for the people who slept there were heaped around another pillar. Yet another pillar had been designated as a play area for children, with a few games and toys and small mats scattered for their use. As we approached the crowd of people, we saw that a great feast was being laid out on clean reed mats. Huge banana leaves served as plates. A team of women scooped out servings of saffron rice, aloo palak, keema, bhaji, and other foods. A battery of kerosene stoves stood nearby, and more food was cooking there. We washed our hands in a drum of water and joined the others, sitting on the floor between Johnny Cigar and Prabhakar's friend Kishore. The food was much more piquantly spiced with chilies and curries than any available in restaurants in the city, and much more delicious. As was customary, the women had their own banquet, laid out some 5 meters away. Carla was the only female in our group of 20 men.
"How are you liking the party?"
Johnny asked Carla, as the first course of foods was being replaced by the second.
"It's great," she replied. "Damn nice food. Damn nice place to eat it."
"Ah, here is the new daddy," Johnny called out. "Come here, Dilip. Meet Miss Carla, a friend of Lynn's who has come to eat with us."
Dilip bowed low with his hands pressed together in greeting, and then moved away, smiling shyly, to supervise the preparation of tea at two large stoves. He worked as a rigger on the site. The site manager had given him the day off to organise the feast for his family and friends. His hut was on the legal side of the slum, but close to my own across the wire. Beside the women's banquet area, just beyond Dilip's tea stoves, two men were attempting to clean something from the wall. A word that someone had painted there was still legible beneath their scrubbing. It was the word Shapna, written in large English capitals.
"What is that?" I asked Johnny Cigar. "I've seen it everywhere lately."
"It's bad, Lin Baba,"
he spat out, crossing himself superstitiously.
"It's the name of a thief, a gunda. He's a bad fellow. He's been doing evil things all over the city. He's been breaking into houses and stealing and even killing.
Did you say killing?
Carla asked. The skin on her lips was tight, and her jaw was set in a hard, grim line.
Yes, Johnny insisted. First it was just words, in posters and such, and writing on the walls. Now it has come to murder. Cold blood murder. Two people were killed in their own houses just last night.
He's so crazy, this Shapner. He uses a girl's name,
Jitendra sneered. It was a good point. The word Shapner, meaning dream, was feminine and a fairly common girl's name.
Not so crazy,
Prabhakar disagreed, his eyes gleaming but his expression grave.
He tells that he is the king of thieves. He talks about making it war to help the poor people and killing the rich peoples.
This is crazy, yes. But it is the kind of a crazy that many people will agree with inside the quiet of their own heads.
Who is he? I asked. Nobody knows who he is, Lynn, Kishore said, his American-accented English, learnt from tourists, flowing in a liquid drawl. A lot of people are talking about him, but nobody I spoke to has ever seen him. People say he's the son of a rich man. They say he's from Delhi, and that he got cut out of his inheritance. But some people also say he's a devil. Some people think that it's not a man at all, but a kind of organization-like. There are posters stuck up around the place, posters telling the thieves and the poor buggers and the Jhopadpattis to do crazy things. And like Johnny said, now two people have been murdered. The name Shapner is getting painted on walls and streets all over Bombay. The cops are asking a lot of questions. I think they're scared.
The rich peoples are scared too, Prabhakar added. They were rich people, those unlucky fellows, killed in their homes. This Shapner fellow is writing his name in English letters, not the Hindi writing. This is an educated fellow. And who painted that name here, in this place? The peoples are always here, always work or sleep, but nobody has seen who painted his name. An educated ghost. Rich peoples are also scared. Not so crazy, this Shapner fellow.
Madachud, pagal,
Johnny spat again. Motherfucker, madman.
He's troubled, this Shapner. And the trouble will be ours, you know, because trouble is the only property that poor fellows like us are allowed to own.
I think we might change the subject, guys, I interjected, looking at Carla. Her face was pale, and her eyes were wide with what seemed to be fright. Are you okay?
I'm fine, she answered quickly. Maybe that elevator ride was scarier than I thought.
Sorry for problem, Miss Carla,
Prabhakar apologized, his face pinched in a solicitous frown.
From now, only happy talking. No more talking about killing and murders and blood all over the houses and all that.
That should cover it, Prabhu, I muttered through clenched teeth, glaring at him. Several young women came to clear the used banana leaves away and lay out small dishes of sweet rubdi dessert for us. They stared at Carla with frank fascination.
Her legs are too thin, one of them said in Hindi. You can see them through the pants.
And her feet are too big, said another.
But her hair is very soft and a good black Indian color, said a third.
Her eyes are the color of stinkweed, said the first, with a contemptuous sniff.
Be careful, sisters, I laughed, speaking in Hindi. My friend speaks perfect Hindi, and she understands everything you're saying.
The women reacted with shocked skepticism, chattering amongst themselves. One of them stooped to stare into Carla's face and asked her loudly if she spoke Hindi.
My legs may be too thin and my feet may be too big, Carla replied in fluent Hindi. But there's nothing wrong with my hearing.
The women shrieked in delight and crowded around her, laughing happily. They pleaded with her to join them, sweeping her away to the women's banquet. I watched her for some time, surprised to see her smile and even laugh out loud in the company of the women and the young girls. She was the most beautiful woman I'd ever known. It was the beauty of a desert at dawn, a loveliness that filled my eyes and crushed me into silent, unbreathing awe. Looking at her there, in the village in the sky, watching her laugh, it shocked me to think that I'd deliberately avoided her for so many months. I was no less surprised by how tactile the girls were with her, how easily they reached out to stroke her hair or to take her hands in their own. I'd perceived her to be aloof and almost cold. In less than a minute, those women were more familiar with her than I'd dared to be in more than a year of friendship. I remembered the quick, impulsive kiss she'd given me in my hut. I remembered the smell of cinnamon and jasmine in her hair, and the press of her lips, like sweet grapes swollen with the summer sun. Tea arrived, and I took my glass to stand near one of the huge window openings that looked out over the slum. Far below, the tattered cloak of the ghetto spread outward from the construction site to the very edge of the sea. The narrow lanes, obscured by ragged overhangs, were only partially visible and seemed more like tunnels than streets. Smoke rose in drifts from cooking fires and stuttered on a sluggish seaward breeze to disperse over a scattering of canoes that fished the muddy shore. Inland from the slum, there were a large number of tall apartment buildings, the expensive homes of the middle rich. From my perch, I looked down at the fabulous gardens of palms and creepers on the tops of some, and the miniature slums that servants of the rich had built for themselves on the tops of others. Mould and mildew scarred every building, even the newest. I'd come to think of it as beautiful, that decline and decay, creeping across the face of the grandest designs, that stain of the end, spreading across every bright beginning in Bombay.
You're right. It is a good view, Carla said quietly as she joined me.
I come up here at night sometimes, when everyone's asleep, I said just as quietly. It's one of my favourite places to be alone. We were silent for a while, watching the crows hover and dip over the slum. So, where's your favourite place to be alone?
I don't like to be alone, she said flatly, and then turned in time to see my expression. What's the matter?
I guess I'm surprised. I thought of you as someone who's good at being alone. I don't mean that in a bad way. I just think of you as sort of aloof, sort of above it all.
Your aim is off, she smiled. Below it all would be more like it.
Wow, twice in one day.
What?
That's twice in one day that I've seen a big smile. You were smiling with the girls before, and I was thinking that it's the first time I've ever seen you really smile.
Well, of course I smile.
Don't get me wrong. I like it. Not smiling can be very attractive. Give me an honest frown over a false smile any day. It looks right on you. You look, I don't know, sort of satisfied not smiling. Or maybe honest is the right word. It looks right on you somehow. Or I thought it did, until I saw you smiling today.
Of course I smile, she repeated,
her brow creasing in a frown, while her tightly pressed lips wrestled with the smile. We were silent again, staring at each other instead of the view. Her eyes were reef green, flecked with gold, and they shone with the luminous intensity that's usually a sign of suffering or intelligence, or both. A clean wind stirred her shoulder-length hair. Very dark hair, the same black-brown as her eyebrows and long lashes. Her lips were a fine, unpainted pink, parted to reveal the tip of her tongue between even, white teeth. She leaned against the windowless frame with her arms folded. The tides of the breeze rippled through the loose silk of her blouse, revealing and concealing her figure. What were you and the girls laughing about? She raised one eyebrow in the familiar sardonic half-smile.
Are you making small talk with me?
Maybe I am, I laughed. I think you're making me nervous. Sorry.
Don't worry about it. I take it as a compliment. To both of us. If you really want to know, it was mostly about you.
Me?
Yeah. They were talking about you hugging a bear.
Oh, that. Well, it was pretty funny, I guess.
One of the women was imitating the look you had on your face just before you did it, and they cracked up over that. But the really funny thing to them was figuring out why you did it. Everyone took turns at guessing why. Radha, she said she's your neighbor, right?
Yeah, she's Satisha's mother.
Well, Radha said you hugged the bear because you felt sorry for it. That got a big laugh.
I'll bet, I mumbled dryly. What did you say?
I said you probably did it because you're a guy who's interested in everything and wants to know everything.
It's funny you say that. A girlfriend of mine once told me, a long time ago, that she was attracted to me because I was interested in everything. She said she left me for the same reason. What I didn't tell Carla was that the girlfriend had described me as interested in everything and committed to nothing. It still rankled. It still hurt. It was still true.
Are you interested in helping me with something? Carla asked. Her tone was suddenly serious, portentous.
So that's it, I thought. That's why she came to see me. She wants something. The spiteful cat of wounded pride arched behind my eyes. She didn't miss me. She wanted something from me. But she had come. She was asking me, not someone else. And there was salvage in that. Looking into those serious green eyes, I sensed that it was rare for her to ask anyone for help. I also had the feeling that a great deal, maybe too much, was balanced in it. Sure, I said, careful not to hesitate for too long. What do you want me to do? She swallowed hard, pushing past an obvious reluctance, and spoke in a rush of words.
There's this girl, a friend of mine. Her name's Lisa. She's got herself in a very bad situation. She started working at this place, a place for foreign call girls. Anyway, Lisa messed up. Now she owes money, a lot of it, and the madame who runs the place where she works won't let her go. I want to get her out of there.
I don't have much, but I think...
It's not the money. I've got the money. But the woman who runs the place has taken a liking to Lisa. Even if we pay, she won't let her go. I know what she's like. It's personal now. The money's just an excuse. What she really wants is to break Lisa, a little at a time, until there's nothing left. She hates her because Lisa's beautiful and bright, and she's got guts. She won't let her leave.
You want us to break her out of there?
Not exactly.
I know some people, I said, thinking of Abdullah Taheri and his mafia friends. They're not afraid of a fight. We could ask them to help.
No, I've got friends here too. They could get her out of there easy enough, but that wouldn't stop the heavies from finding her and taking it out on her later. They don't mess around. They use acid. Lisa wouldn't be the first girl to get acid thrown in her face because she got on the wrong side of Madame Zhou. We can't risk it. Whatever we do, it has to be in a way that convinces her to leave Lisa alone forever.
I was uneasy about it. I sensed that there was more to it than Carla was telling me. Did you say Madame Zhou?
Yes. Have you heard of her?
A bit. I nodded. I don't know how much of it to believe. People say some pretty wild and dirty things about her.
The wild things, I don't know. But the dirty things are all true. Take it from me. I didn't feel any better about it. Why doesn't she just run away, this friend of yours? Why doesn't she get on a plane and get the hell back to... Where did you say she came from? She's American. Look, if I could make her go back to the States, there wouldn't be a problem. But she won't go back. She won't leave Bombay. She'll never leave Bombay. She's a junkie. That's a big part of it. But there's more than that. Stuff from her past, stuff she can't face back there. So she won't go. I've tried to talk her into it, but it's no good. She just won't. And I can't say that I blame her. I've got issues of my own. Things in my past I'd rather not go back to. Things I won't go back to. And you've got a plan to get this girl out, I mean. Yes. I want you to pretend that you're someone from the American Embassy. Some kind of consulate officer. I've already set it up. You won't have to do much. I'll do most of the talking. We'll tell them that Lisa's father is some big honcho in America with ties to the government, and that you've had orders to get her out of there and keep an eye on her. I'll have all that straight before you even walk in the door.
Sounds pretty fuzzy to me, Carla. You think that'll be enough? She took a bundle of BDs from her pocket and lit two of them with a cigarette lighter, holding the small cigarettes in one hand and playing the flame over them with the other. She passed one to me and puffed deeply on her own before answering me.
I think so. It's the best thing I've come up with. I talked it over with Lisa, and she says she thinks it'll work. If Madame Jo gets her money, and if she believes you're from the embassy, and if she's convinced that she'll get into trouble with the embassy or the government if she hassles Lisa anymore, I think she'll leave her alone. There's a lot of ifs in there, I know. A lot of it really depends on you.
It depends on her, too, this Madame. Do you think she'll believe it? Believe me?
We'll have to play it exactly right. She's more cunning than clever. But she's not stupid.
Do you think I can do this?
How's your American accent?
She asked, with a little embarrassed laugh. I was an actor once, I muttered, in another life.
That's great, she said, reaching out to touch my forearm. Her long, slender fingers felt cool against my warm skin.
I don't know, I frowned. It's a lot of responsibility if it doesn't go down right. If something happens to the girl, or to you.
She's my friend. It's my idea. The responsibility's mine.
I'd feel better about it, you know, just fighting my way in there and fighting my way out again. This embassy thing. There's so many ways it could go wrong.
I wouldn't ask you if I didn't think it was the right way to go. And if I wasn't sure you could do it, Lynn.
She fell silent, waiting. I let her wait. But I knew the answer already. She might have thought I was weighing it up, trying to make up my mind. In fact, I was only thinking about why I was going to do it. Is it for her? I asked myself. Am I committed or just interested? Why did I hug the bear? I smiled. When do we do this? She smiled back.
In a couple of days. I've got to do a bit of stuff first, to set it all up.
She threw the finished beady away and took a step towards me. I think she might have kissed me, but just then a frightened clamour of shouting and shrieks started up among the people, and they ran to join us at the windows. In the jam of bodies, Prabhakar pushed his head through, under my arm and next to Carla.
Municipality, he shouted. BMC is coming. Bombay Municipal Corporation. Look there.
What is it? What's happening? Carla asked.
Her voice was all but lost in the shouts and screams.
It's the council. They're going to tear down some houses, I called back,
my lips close to her ear. They do this every month or so. They're trying to keep the slum under control to stop it from spreading outside the edge there, where it meets the street. We look down near the main street to see 4, 5, 6 large dark blue police trucks rolling into an open area that was a kind of no man's land enclosed by the crescent of the slum. The heavy trucks were covered with canvas tarpaulins. We couldn't see inside them, but we knew they contained squads of cops, 20 or more men to each truck. An open tray truck, loaded with council workers and their equipment, drove between the parked police vehicles and stopped near the huts. Several officers climbed down from the police trucks and deployed their men in 2 rows. The council workers, themselves mostly slum dwellers from other slums, leapt from their truck and set about their task of demolition. Each man had a rope and grappling hook that he swung onto the roof of a hut until it caught fast. He then tugged on the rope, collapsing the fragile hut. The people had just enough time to gather the bare essentials. Babies, money, papers. Everything else was tumbled and raked into the wreckage. Kerosene stoves and cooking pots, bags and bedding, clothes and children's toys. People scattered in panic. The police stopped some of them and then marched a few young men away to the waiting trucks. The people at our windows grew silent as they watched. From our vantage point, we could see the destruction far below, but we couldn't hear even the loudest noise of it. Somehow, the soundlessness of that methodical, scouring obliteration struck at us all. I hadn't noticed the wind until then. It was a moaning wail in that eerie quiet. I knew that all through the 35 floors of the building, above and below us, other people stared mute witness, just as we did. Although the houses of construction workers in the legal slum were safe, all work on the site stopped in sympathy. The workers understood that when the building was finished, it would be their own homes that would lie in ruins. They knew that the ritual they'd all seen so many times before would be played out for the last time. The ghetto would be gutted and burned, and a car park for limousines would take its place. I looked at the faces around me, faces struck with compassion and dread. In the eyes of some, I saw smoulders of shame for what the council's power had forced too many of us to think. Thank God. Thank God it's not me.
Great luck. Your house is safe, Linbaba. Yours and mine also, Prabhakar said, as we watched the cops and council workers climb back onto their trucks and drive away.
They'd scythed and smashed a swath 100 metres long and 10 metres wide at the northeastern corner of the illegal slum. About 60 houses had been obliterated, the homes of at least 200 people. The entire operation had taken less than 20 minutes.
Where will they go? Carla asked quietly.
Most of it'll be back again by this time tomorrow.
Next month they'll come and knock them down again. Or another bunch of huts just like them in another part of the slum. Then that'll be rebuilt. But it's still a big loss. All their things have been smashed up. They have to buy new bamboo and mats and stuff to make new houses. And people got arrested. We might not see them again for months.
I don't know what scares me more, she declared. The madness that smashes people down, or their ability to endure it.
Most of the people had left the window, but Carla and I remained as close together as we'd been in the push and shove of the crowd. My arm was around her shoulder. On the ground, 20 floors below, people began to pick through the rubble of their homes. Canvas and plastic shelters were already being erected for the elderly, the babies, and the smallest children. She turned to face me, and I kissed her. The taut bow of her lips dissolved on mine in concessions of flesh to flesh. There was such sad tenderness in it that for a second or two I floated free and was adrift in its inexpressible kindnesses. I'd thought of Carla as streetwise and tough and almost cold, but that kiss was pure, undisguised vulnerability. The gentle loveliness of it shocked me, and I was the first to pull away. "I'm sorry. I didn't..." I faltered. "It's okay," she smiled, leaning away from me with her hands on my chest. "But we might be making one of those pretty girls at the feast jealous."
"Who?
Are you saying you don't have a girl here?"
"No, of course not," I frowned.
"I've got to stop listening to Didier," she sighed. "It was his idea. He thinks you must have a girlfriend here. He thinks that's the only reason you'd stay in the slum. He said that's the only reason any foreigner would stay in the slum."
"I don't have a girlfriend, Carla. Not here or anywhere. I'm in love with you."
"No, you're not," she snapped, and it was like a slap.
"I can't help it. For a long time now, I..."
"Stop it," she interrupted me again. "You're not. You're not. Oh, God, how I hate love."
"You can't hate love, Carla," I said, laughing gently and trying to lighten her mood.
"Maybe not, but you sure as hell can be sick of it. It's such a huge arrogance to love someone, and there's too much of it around. There's too much love in the world. Sometimes I think that's what heaven is, a place where everybody's happy because nobody loves anybody else, ever."
The wind lashed her hair into her face, and she pushed it back with both hands, holding it there with her fingers fanned out across her forehead. She was staring down at her feet.
"What the fuck ever happened to good old meaningless sex without any strings attached?" she rasped, her lips drawn tightly over her teeth.
It wasn't a question, but I answered it anyway. "I'm not ruling that out, as a fallback position, so to speak."
"Look, I don't want to be in love," she stated in a softer tone. She raised her eyes to stare into mine. "I don't want anyone to be in love with me. It hasn't been good to me, the romance thing."
"I don't think it's kind to anyone, Carla."
"My point exactly."
"But when it happens, you haven't got a choice. I don't think it's something any of us do by choice. And I don't want to put any pressure on you. I'm just in love with you, that's all. I've been in love with you for a while, and I finally had to say it. It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it, or me either, for that matter."
"I'm still... I don't know, I'm just... Jesus. But I'm happy to like you. I like you a lot. I'll be head over heels in like with you, Lynn, if that's enough."
Her eyes were honest, and yet I knew there was a lot she wasn't telling me. Her eyes were brave, and yet she was afraid. When I relented and smiled at her, she laughed. I laughed too.
"Is it enough for now?"
"Sure," I lied. "Sure." But already, like the people in the ghetto, hundreds of feet below, I was picking through the smashed houses in my heart and rebuilding on the ruin. Chapter 13. Despite the fact that only a handful of people could claim to have seen Madame Jo with their own eyes, she was the main attraction, Carla assured me, for many of those who visited the palace. Her clients were rich men, executive-level businessmen, politicians, and gangsters. The palace offered them foreign girls, exclusively, for no Indian girls ever worked there, and elaborate facilities for the realization of their wildest sexual fantasies. The strangest of those illicit pleasures, devised by Madame Jo personally, were the subject of shocked, breathless whispers throughout the city. But influential contacts and substantial bribes meant that the palace was immune from raids or even close scrutiny. And although there were other places in Bombay that provided equal indulgence and security, none of them were as popular as Madame Jo's, because none had the Madame herself.
In the end, what kept men coming to the palace wasn't the skill and loveliness of the women they could have there. It was the mystery of the woman they couldn't have. The invisible beauty of Madame Jo. People said she was Russian, but that detail, like all the others concerning her private life, seemed to be unverifiable. It was accepted, Carla said, simply because it was the most persistent rumour. One clear fact was that she'd arrived in New Delhi during the 1960s, a decade as wild for that city as it was for most Western capitals. The new part of the city was celebrating its 30th year then, and Old Delhi its 300th. Madame Jo, most sources agreed, was 29. Legend had it that she'd been the mistress of a KGB officer who'd employed her unique beauty to suborn prominent Congress Party officials. The Congress Party governed India through those years with what seemed to be an unassailable lead in every national poll. Many of the party faithful, and even their enemies, believed that the Congress Party would continue to rule the Indian motherland for 100 years. Power over congressmen, therefore, was power over the nation. The gossip about her years in Delhi prowled from scandals and suicides to political murder. Carla said that she'd heard so many different versions of the stories, from such a wide variety of people, she began to think that the truth, whatever it might have been, wasn't really important to them. Madame Jo had become a kind of portmanteau figure. People packed the details of their own obsessions into her life. One said she possessed a fortune in precious gems that she kept in a Hessian sack. Another talked with authority about her addiction to various drugs. And a third whispered of satanic rites and cannibalism.
People say a lot of really weird stuff about her. And I think some of it's just crap. But the bottom line is, she's dangerous, Carla said. Devious and dangerous.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding. Don't underestimate her. When she moved from Delhi to Bombay 6 years ago, there was a murder trial, and she was at the center of it. Two very important guys ended up dead in her Delhi palace, both of them with their throats cut. One of them happened to be a police inspector. The trial fell apart when one witness against her disappeared, and another was found hanging from the doorway of his house. She left Delhi to set up shop in Bombay, and within the first 6 months there was another murder, only a block away from the palace, and a lot of people connected her with it. But she's got so much stuff on so many people, stuff that goes all the way to the top. They can't touch her. She can do pretty much what she likes, because she knows she'll get away with it. If you want to get out of this, now's your chance.
We were in a Bumblebee, one of the ubiquitous black and yellow Fiat taxis, travelling south through the steel bazaar. Traffic was heavy. Hundreds of wooden handcarts, longer and taller and wider than a car when fully laden, trundled along between buses and trucks, pushed by barefoot porters, 6 men to each cart. The main streets of the steel bazaar were crammed with small and medium shops. They sold every kind of metal houseware, from kerosene stoves to stainless steel sinks, and most of the cast iron and sheet metal products required by builders, shop fitters, and decorators. The shops themselves were adorned with gleaming metalwares, strung in such brilliantly polished plenty and such artful array that they often attracted the camera lenses of tourists. Behind the glossy commercial ramble of the streets, however, were the hidden lanes, where men who were paid in cents rather than dollars worked at black and gritty furnaces to produce those shining lures. The windows of the cab were open, but no breeze stirred through them. It was hot and still in the sluggish churn of traffic. We'd stopped at Carla's apartment on the way, where I'd swapped my T-shirt, jeans and boots for a pair of dress shoes, conservatively cut black trousers, a starched white shirt and a tie. The only thing I'd like to get out of at the moment are these clothes, I grumbled.
What's wrong with them?
She asked, a mischievous gleam in her eye. They're itchy and horrible.
They'll be fine.
I hope we don't have an accident. I'd really hate to get killed in these clothes.
Actually, they look pretty good on you.
Oh, shit, make my day.
Hey, come on, she chided, curling her lip in an affable smirk. Her accent, the accent I'd come to love and consider the most interesting in the world, gave every word a rounded resonance that thrilled me. The music of that accent was Italian, its shape was German, its humour and its attitude were American, and its colour was Indian. Being so fussy about dressing down the way you do is a kind of vanity, you know. It's fairly conceited, too.
I don't dress down, I just hate clothes.
No, you don't. You love clothes.
What is this? I've got one pair of boots, one pair of jeans, one shirt, two T-shirts, and a couple of lungis. That's it. My whole wardrobe. If I'm not wearing it, it's hanging on a nail in my hut.
That's my point. You love clothes so much that you can't bear to wear anything but the few things that feel just right.
I fidgeted with the prickly collar of the shirt.
Well, Carla, these clothes are a long way from just right. How come you've got so many men's clothes at your place anyway? You've got more men's clothes than I have.
The last two guys who lived with me left in kind of a hurry.
So much of a hurry that they left their clothes behind?
Yes.
Why?
One of them got very busy, she said quietly.
Busy doing what?
He was breaking a mess of laws, so he probably wouldn't want me to talk about it.
Did you kick him out?
No.
She said it flatly, but with such a clear sense of regret that I let it go.
And the other guy?
You don't want to know.
I did want to know, but she turned her face away to stare out the window, and there was a finality in the gesture that warned and prohibited. I'd heard that Carla had once lived with someone named Ahmed, an Afghan. People didn't talk about it much, and I'd assumed that they'd broken up years before. In the year that I knew her, she'd lived alone in the apartment. And I hadn't realized until that moment how deeply that image of her had insinuated itself into my sense of who she was and how she lived. Despite her protest that she didn't like to be alone, I'd thought of her as one of those people who never lived with others. Someone who let people visit or even stay overnight, but never more than that. I looked at the back of her head, at the small part of her profile, at the barely perceptible bump of her breasts beneath the green shawl, and the long, thin fingers making prayer in her lap. And I couldn't imagine her living with someone. Breakfast and bare backs, bathroom noises and bad moods, domestic and demi-married, it was impossible to see her in that. Perversely, I found it easier to imagine Ahmed, the Afghan roommate I'd never met, than it was to imagine her as anything but alone and complete. We sat in silence for 5 minutes, a silence calibrated by the slow metronome of the taxi's meter. An orange banner hanging from the dashboard of the car proclaimed that the driver, like many others in Bombay, was from Uttar Pradesh, a large and populous state in India's northeast. Our slow progress through the traffic jam gave him many chances to study us in the rear vision mirror. He was intrigued. Carla had spoken to him in fluent Hindi, giving him precise, street-by-street directions to the palace. We were foreigners who behaved like locals. He decided to test us.
Sister fucking traffic,
he muttered in street Hindi, as if to himself, but his eyes never left the mirror.
The whole fucking city is constipated today.
A 20-rupee tip might make a good laxative,
Carla fired back in Hindi.
What are you doing, renting this taxi by the hour? Get a move on, brother.
Yes, miss,
the driver replied in English through delighted laughter. He applied himself with more energy to bullying his way through the traffic. So, what did happen to him? I asked her.
To who?
To the other guy you lived with. The one who didn't break a mess of laws.
He died, if you must know,
she said, her teeth clenched.
So, how did he die?
They say he poisoned himself.
They say?
Yeah,
she sighed, looking away to let her eyes drift in the shuffle of people on the street. We drove in silence for a few moments, and then I had to speak. Which one of them owned this outfit I'm wearing? The law-breaking one or the dead one?
The dead one.
Okay.
I bought it for him to get buried in.
Shit. Shit what? She demanded, turning to face me again and frowning hard. Shit nothing. But remind me to get the name of your dry cleaner.
We didn't need it. They buried him in a different outfit of clothes. I bought the suit, but in the end we didn't use it.
I see.
I told you that you didn't want to know.
No. It's okay, I mumbled. And in fact, I felt a cruel secret relief that the former lover was dead, gone. No competition to me. I was too young then to know that dead lovers are the toughest rivals. Still, Carla, I don't mean to be picky, but you've got to admit it's just a tad creepy. We're off on a dangerous mission and I'm sitting here in a dead guy's burial suit.
You're just being superstitious.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
I'm not superstitious.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
Of course you are, she said, giving me her first real smile since we'd started in the taxi. Everyone in the whole world is superstitious.
I don't want to fight about it. Might be bad luck.
Don't worry, she laughed. We'll be okay. Look, here are your business cards. Madame Jo likes to collect them. She'll ask you for one. And she'll keep it in case she needs a favor from you. But if it ever comes to that, she'll find that you're long gone from the embassy.
The cards were made of pearl-white, textured linen paper, and the words were embossed in liquid black italic. They declared that Gilbert Parker was a consular undersecretary at the Embassy of the United States of America. Gilbert, I grunted.
So what?
So this taxi crashes and they gouge my body out of the wreckage wearing these clothes and they identify me as Gilbert. I'm not feeling any better about this, Carla, I have to say.
Well, you'll have to settle for Gilbert at the moment. There really is a Gilbert Parker at the embassy. His tour of duty in Bombay finishes today. That's why we picked him. He goes back to the States tonight. So everything will check out okay. I don't think she'll be checking up on you too much anyway. Maybe a phone call, but she might not even do that. If she wants to get in touch with you, she'll do it through me. She had some trouble with the British Embassy last year. It cost her plenty. And a German diplomat got into a real mess at the palace a few months ago. She had to call in a lot of dues to cover that up. The embassies are the only people who can really hurt her, so she won't be pushing it. Just be polite and firm when you speak to her. And speak some Hindi. She'll expect it. And it'll smooth over any trouble with your accent. That's one of the reasons why I asked you to help me with this, you know? You've picked up a lot of Hindi for someone who's only been here a year.
14 months, I corrected her, feeling slighted by her shorter estimate. 2 months when I first got to Bombay, 6 months in Prabhakar's village, and now nearly 6 months in the slum. 14 months.
Yes, okay. 14 months.
I thought no one got to meet this Madame Jo, I said, hoping to shift the puzzled, uncomfortable frown from her features. You said she kept herself hidden away and never talked to anyone.
That's true, but it's a little more complicated than that, Carla replied softly.
A meditation of memories clouded her eyes for a moment, but then she concentrated again with obvious effort.
She lives on the top floor and has everything she needs up there. She never goes out. She has 2 servants who bring food and clothes and stuff up to her. She can move around the building without being seen, because there's a lot of hidden passageways and staircases. She can look in on most of the rooms through 2-way mirrors or metal air vents. She likes to watch. Sometimes she talks to people through a screen. You can't see her, but she can see you.
So how does anyone know what she looks like?
Her photographer.
Of what?
She has photographs taken of herself. A new one every month or so. She gives them out to favored clients.
It's pretty weird, I muttered. Not really interested in Madame Jo, but wanting Carla to go on talking. I watched her red-pink lips form each word. Lips I'd kissed only days before. And her speaking mouth was a sublime performance of perfect flesh. She could have been reading from a month-old newspaper, and I would have been just as delighted to watch her face, her eyes, and her lips as she talked. Why does she do it?
Do what?
She asked, her eyes narrowing with the question. Why does she hide herself away like that?
I don't think anyone knows.
She took out two beadies, lit them, and gave me one. Her hands appeared to be trembling.
It's like I was saying before. There's so much crazy talk about her. I've heard people say she was horribly disfigured in an accident, and she hides her face because of it. They say the photos are retouched to cover up the scars. I've heard people say she has leprosy or some other disease. One friend of mine says she doesn't exist at all. He says it's just a lie, a kind of conspiracy, to hide who really runs the place and what goes on there.
What do you think?
I've spoken to her through the screen. I think she's so incredibly, psychopathically vain that she sort of hates herself for getting older. I think she can't bear to be less than perfect. A lot of people say she was beautiful. Really, you'd be surprised. A lot of people say that. In her photos, she hasn't aged past 27 or 30. There aren't any lines or wrinkles. There's no shadows under the eyes. Every black hair is in its place. I think she's so in love with her own beauty. She'll never let anyone see her as she really is. I think it's like she's mad with love for herself. I think that even if she lives to be 90, those monthly photos will still show that same 30-year-old blank.
How do you know so much about her? I asked. How did you meet her?
I'm a facilitator. It was part of my job.
That doesn't tell me a lot.
How much do you need to know?
It was a simple question, and there was a simple answer. I love you, and I want to know everything. But there was a hard edge to her voice and a cold light in her eyes, and I faltered. I'm not trying to pry, Carla. I didn't know it was such a touchy area. I've known you for more than a year, and okay, I haven't seen you every day or even every month, but I've never asked you what you do or how you make your living. I don't think that qualifies me as the nosy type.
I put people together,
she said, relaxing a little.
And I make sure they're having the right amount of fun to seal a deal. I get paid to keep people in the deal-making mood and give them what they want. Some of them, quite a few of them as it happens, want to spend time at Madame Jo's palace. The real question is why people are so crazy about her. She's dangerous. I think she's completely insane. But people would do almost anything to meet her.
What do you think? She sighed, exasperated.
I can't tell you. It's not just the sex thing. Sure, the prettiest foreign girls in Bombay work for her, and she trains them in some very weird specialties. But people would still come to her even if there weren't any gorgeous girls there. I don't get it. I've done what people want, and I've taken them to the palace. A few of them even got to meet her in person, like I did, through the screen. But I've never been able to figure it out. They come out of the palace like they've had an audience with Joan of Arc. They're high on it. But not me. She gives me the creeps, and she always has.
You don't like her much, do you? It's worse than that.